is John McMurray with the Society for American Baseball Research, and I'm recording this oral history with Randy Jones on July the 2nd, 2019. And Randy, you had one of the more interesting careers of the 70s and early 80s, and I wondered if you could describe for me what got you interested in baseball in the first place?
You know, I just, as a child at 7 years old, I liked sports. I was infatuated with all of them, of course, as a youth, and as a lot of us were. But baseball was the one that really stuck into my heart. And I just remember, you know, playing Pee Wee League when I was 7 years old and got on the mound. And I mean, it was so long ago that the umpire stood behind me, you know, the pitcher's mound. He wouldn't get behind home plate. Catcher couldn't catch anyway at 7 years old. So, but I just fell in love with it. It just kind of never left my heart and my mind. I mean, I love playing all the other sports and competing, but when it all boiled down to it, I was most excited when baseball season came around, and it was always that way. And then finally, by my senior year in high school, I specialized and went strictly to baseball, and I don't regret that for 1 minute.
And did you always think of being a pitcher, or were you a hitter when you were
younger? Well, you know, we're all hitters, athletes, when we're younger. But, yeah, I was always a pitcher first.
You were always known for your great sinker.
Yes.
When did that first develop?
Well, you know, I just think overall, you know, you go through your childhood, and I hurt my elbow a couple of times. And by the time I got to, you know, my sophomore year or my junior year in college, when I, you know, I'd hurt it again and had to take the year off. And when I came back, I lost an awful lot of velocity, and the one thing I still had is great control and movement for a left-hander, and so I utilized that and continued just to learn how to pitch and not throw. I just knew how to change speeds and get hitters out, and that's kind of what it was all about. But it was having command of the strike zone, and was one of the key integral parts.
There seems to be such an emphasis these days on throwing hard.
Right.
And it sounds as though you didn't have that when you were coming up.
No, I did not. I, you know, unless you want to call 87 miles an hour hard, which I wouldn't call that. And I realized in my college days that, you know, sometimes less is better, you know, as far as, you know, hitters and their weaknesses and how you get them out. I enjoyed that. It was a challenge to me. You know, like, and I said, you know, like today, it's all radar guns and 90 plus miles an hour for a scout to even probably come look at you. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have been looked at in the old days. The only thing I knew how to do, John, was win. That's all I knew how to do. And I continued to do that, you know, throughout my career. I just kept winning every year.
You think about guys, some of the pitchers who were the best, Tommy John or someone like that, wasn't going to overpower you.
That's right.
Phil Niekro, of course, we don't see knuckleballers the way that we did before. Why do you think baseball doesn't look for guys who are just good at pitching a lot of innings, getting guys out, and as you say, winning?
Well, I just, you know, think that power arm, and I mean, it's marketing 101 for baseball, in my opinion, right now. Mm-hmm. And we've seen baseball go through, you know, go through trends and everything, and sooner or later, I don't know how many years it might take, but it'll roll back around a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the almighty 100-mile-an-hour fastball, there'll always be an infatuation with it. But I think sooner or later, some of these teams and managers are going to get smart enough to work. Power arms are good. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But if you have a five-man rotation and you sandwich in maybe a couple of other guys that pitch to contact a little bit, mm-hmm. and number one, it'll complement your power arms that can't go deep into games just because of the, you know, the sheer, you know, your struggle it is and how hard it is to throw at max speed every single pitch. It's mm-hmm. not easy to do, so. If you sandwich in a couple of guys that pitch to contact, more like a i.e. Randy Jones, Tommy John type kid, you know, they're going to go deeper in the game, which is going to spell your bullpen. And it just works out better. And I see that that's going to be a trend sooner or later. Somebody's going to figure this out. I've been telling the, you know, the organization that, you know, you should get a couple of guys 95, 96 to be your first two starters. And then that third guy, find a Randy Jones. Slip him in there as a third man in the rotation. Mm-hmm. I think there's no way in the world that other team can adjust. If he knows what he's doing, you're going to have on their front foot all day long. They're used to 95 plus, and there's just no way in the world they can wait on 85, 80 miles an hour. They just can't do it. You know, it'd be a real advantage, I think.
you know, and there are guys that you think Mike Flanagan, Scott McGregor, people yes. like that. You know, teams would win World Series with guys who went off speed or who had a great curveball. And
well, what you're describing is you know, you got guys that know how to pitch, mm-hmm. work a hitter's weakness. You know, now right now it's all power arms, and yeah, let's challenge somebody. Here we go. You know, and we kind of see how that's working out. It's not working out that well right now. You know, let's say like 6-inning starts from every pitcher, and you know, an all-time record for home runs.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, you've got a lot of throwers out there that don't know how to pitch. Mm-hmm. And once all of a sudden you see some of these young men start to get good after a couple of years, it's when they finally learn how to pitch and they understand that less is better. I mean, that 95 might set them up, but it's going to be 85 or 87 that's going to get them out a lot of times. And then you slowly see the transition where these guys learn that and understand that, and it's kind of enjoyable once they figure it out.
You know, we went to high school in California, and then you went to college in California, and
right.
then you got drafted in California, so you must have been quite happy about that.
Well, I was. I mean, you're born and raised in one area, and it's been Southern California. I was just lucky when the Padres drafted me, and I was 22 years old when I signed, so I was older at the time, so I started really in Double-A baseball. And, you know, 20 starts later, I was in San Diego. So a little bit of luck, a little bit of good timing and everything, but it was a coincidence that I've just lived on my whole life here in Southern California.
But there's an advantage to having waited a little bit instead of being someone drafted right out of high school who didn't have that.
And, well, I knew coming out of high school, number one, I knew I wasn't mature enough to actually go out and play professional baseball. And I knew that. And when you throw 85 miles an hour, you've got to go in the back of your mind that it might not be the career that you're going to end up with.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured my college education was imperative. And so I let baseball pay for my college education. That's what I wanted baseball to do at the time. And in the back of my mind, you always have the dream about being a big league baseball player or a pitcher. That never went away, but, you know, you better have a backup plan, a little bit of reality check. And so by the time I signed, you know, like I said, I had my business degree, and I was ready to go to work if that didn't pan out. And that, you know, luckily it did. And like I say, the rest is on the back of my bubblegum card. That's just kind of the way it worked.
How did you feel about going to the Padres? In the sense, they were not a team that had a track record of success. There were rumors early in your career the team might even move to Washington D.C.
Right.
And it was definitely a group that was finding its way.
Yeah, I mean, young franchise. The one thing when I first signed, I thought Detroit was going to draft me. I talked to them. And I think they had me for the sixth round of the 72 draft. And all of a sudden, the Padres, I'd never talked to anybody on the Padres, and they drafted me in the fifth round. And my first thought when I signed with them is it was an advantage to me, a young expansion team just growing. And I knew that I'm going to get a lot more opportunities with the San Diego Padres in the early 70s than I ever would have with the Detroit Tigers in the 70s. I'm not going to take Denny McClain and Mickey Lolich out of the rotation and that type of thing. And so I just knew that if I was going to have an opportunity, I really thought that was unique, where it might be created right here with San Diego. And I was right, as it turned out.
Was there a particular player when you first got there who helped ease your transition into the major leagues?
I think Nate Colbert was probably a real key. Nate, was very personable, and he kind of took me under his wing and taught me a lot. You know, just about the major league etiquette, and even on the road and everything that we did. Nate was invaluable in doing that. I mean, good friend. That did help, and that was old school, where you didn't say much anyway as a rookie. I didn't hardly say a word. You know, I got the ball, and Don Zimmer, my manager, gave me the baseball, and I didn't say much. And, you know, that's just the way you're supposed to do it as a rookie, and that's what I did.
Was Zimmer good with young players?
He was good by me. I mean, he was hard on everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, short on patience and yelled a lot. But that was baseball in the 70s.
Okay.
I mean, I was used to it.
Just a crusty.
Yeah, a crusty old, right-hander. And it was good. Never bothered me. College was the same way when I went to college. So, I was kind of used to it.
So when you get to the major leagues, do they just hand you the ball and say, hey, go out and do this? Or does someone try and make you into a particular kind of pitcher?
No, they just hand me the baseball and said, go get them. Just do what you've been doing. And that's exactly what I did. And before that, and actually you talk about, the sinker ball, that started Warren Hacker, an old Pittsburgh Pirate pitcher. was one of our minor league coaches. And spring training in 73, Morton Hacker came up to me and asked me if I'd, you know, ever tried to throw the sinker. And I went, well, not really. And so he just basically kind of get me. I always turn the ball over. But, I mean, just to roll the ball off my fingertips a little bit. So I started experimenting with it a little bit in spring training. And I just, duck and water, man. I took right to it just because of the way I pitched. And then, you know, first month, I didn't see it sink. Everybody's saying, man, it's sinking pretty good. I couldn't see it. And I'm going, well, if you say so. And I, you know, I just kept throwing the ball the same way I always did. But then all of a sudden, when the 73 season started in Double-A in the Texas League, it was like, the second or third inning. I threw a pitch to lead off of the second or third inning, and the bottom fell out of it. I looked at it, what was that? You know, and it's kind of game on. As soon as I saw that and started understanding it, and that's when I started experimenting with a little bit of changing speeds on it. And I found I could change speeds on that sinker and still hit the same spot. And it was really unique, you know, in my arsenal. And I had a tendency, then I started throwing my slider a little bit harder than a lot of times my sinker. So I throw the breaking ball harder than my fastball.
I get the sense that you had to kind of figure out what worked for you and experiment, as opposed to having the coaches instruct you on every pitch or modification.
Yes, exactly. And, I mean, through the transition of years, you know, in 74, I'm 8-22.
Yeah.
There's, you know, of course, we lost 102 games as a franchise, so somebody had to lose some ball games.
That's right.
I think I got shut out 12 times or something that year. I think I got no runs.
ERA was 4.45.
Yeah.
So it was still...
It was actually almost decent until, like, take my last 8 starts, completely lost my confidence and got beat up pretty good at the end of the year in 74. But I took that and tried to rationalize why. And, you know, it seemed like it was always late in those games in 74 that I'd get a little fatigued and I'd elevate that sinker and I'd get burned. I'd lose then. I didn't lose early in the game prototypically. So I just know I had to get in better shape, and I changed my mechanics a little bit with the help of Tom Morgan, my new pitching coach, made some adjustments. And I ran harder. I worked harder. You know, at my craft, and I got more consistent. And even in spring training, I could tell the difference before we broke in 75, how much better. And as spring training went along, I got more confident, and it rolled out over into the season of 75.
It's hard when you lose your confidence as a young pitcher to actually go and get it back.
Oh,
you know, you have to be worried they're going to send you down, not give you additional chances. Especially with a team like that was an expansion team, you know, are they really going to stick with me?
That's exactly the way I felt. In fact, that spring in 75, I didn't give up one run. I think I pitched 30 innings in spring training in 75, and I didn't even give up a run that spring. That's how hard I worked, and I was serious about it. And then I did so well that I ended up being opening night pitcher in 75, which I never expected. But.
So you went from losing 20 to winning 20, leading the league in ERA, and it was basically because of that change, because of better conditioning and not getting and letting your sinker rise.
That's right. You know, being just stronger, and I had 18 complete games that year. I pitched 285 innings, going deeper into ball games and not getting tired, more consistent, you know, and I think that went along with the better I pitched, I think the better I concentrated and really got into it. And I learned a lot in 75 on what it took and carried that right over into the Cy Young year in 76.
Tell me about Dave Winfield as a young player.
Dave was a great ball player. I mean, I got up just before he did. That's how I got to the big leagues, you know. They wanted to sign Winfield. They drafted him number one. They didn't have the money to... Exciting. I think they needed like $60,000, so they sold Freddie Norman, the left-handed pitcher, to the Cincinnati Reds.
Yeah.
And that left a void at the major league level, and I was 8-1 at the time in the Texas League. I was pitching really well, and I think I walked like 4 guys in 10 starts. I wasn't walking anybody. And so Don Zimmer said, well, get that Jones kid up here. He don't walk anybody. He'll give him a shot. And so that's how I got to the big leagues, because of that transaction. So Winfield actually was an integral part of getting me to the big leagues.
Sometimes it's what you do, and sometimes it's the things around you.
Yeah, like I said, I'd rather be lucky than good sometimes.
You know,
I was in the right spot at the right time.
Did you have any particular pitcher that you modeled your style after?
No. No, there was nobody. In fact, and then on, if I've done one, I've probably done 20,000 private pitching lessons, and I don't think I've ever taught anybody how to pitch like I did. So, I mean, it takes a unique set of circumstances and things you're doing naturally for me to do that. And I honestly never saw a kid that was that close. I had to make a few changes, sure, fundamentally, that I knew were just sound fundamentals, but as far as teaching somebody how to throw a sinker ball, no. I think sometimes the good Lord's got to give you that, and then you can enhance it, but you can't, I don't know if you can teach it.
So how would you approach someone like, suppose, you know, you come up in, you know, let's say you're pitching, you come up in 73, you're pitching to Hank Aaron in 74. I mean, what do you do?
Yeah.
How do you approach him?
I faced Aaron in Mays, and, you know, of course, I gave up my home runs to him. First time I faced both of them, I gave up a home run to both of them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I learned more from that. You know, but it was just a matter of changing speeds the same way. I mean, a lot of times you got to realize even great hitters fail 7 out of 10 times. So if you give them an opportunity, they'll get themselves out. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much Randy Jones getting these guys out. They were getting themselves out. I just had to deliver the right pitch at the right time to help them.
So if Willie Mays comes up, do you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to throw him a curveball in the first pitch, a fastball in the second pitch, or do you go with the feel? Well, he didn't swing at the first pitch.
You always go with the feel, but you always have a game plan. I knew the third pitch to a hitter usually most of the time. I knew the first three pitches.
Okay.
In my own mind. But you have to adjust. I mean, if you throw a sinker ball and he fouls it straight back and he's dead on it, you make adjustments. You know, I'm not going back there again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're going to add or subtract and move location. And you have to be able to do that. But you know, overall, if you make a mistake, good hitters are going to hurt you. That's then and today is the same thing. You know, and that's what happens. You make mistakes, major league hitters take advantage of it. They don't miss them that often. And so it's just a matter of making the right pitch, you know, at the right time. So maybe a little more advantage for me, changing speeds, getting hitters on their front foot, getting hard to square up on the baseball. That's a, you know, ground ball pitcher, and that's what I was looking for. So, you know, and I'd work hard at that, make sure that I could do that.
To what degree does the catcher call the game, or do you decide what you're going to throw?
Well, it's always the pitcher that'll decide. I had good catchers, and you know, I had such good command and confidence in myself, and they could call whatever they wanted to, because you know the one thing about a pitch, but it, the speed of it was up to me.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I wouldn't decide that halfway through my windup. I decide how hard I wanted to throw it, or how, you know, if I wanted to add to it, or like you throw some really good sinker balls early, and all of a sudden you've given up two or three hits in the 5.5 hole between third and short.
Yeah.
And to me, that tells me it's the wrong speed. Right location, wrong speed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd usually add a little bit and see what happened. Now all of a sudden the ball's going to the shortstop. All right, so now we got a basis to start.
Okay.
And I would do that quite a bit.
So it's making these tiny in-game adjustments.
That's right.
That you have to be observant and sort of say, here's what I wanted, here's what happened, now I have to change.
Yes.
X, Y, Z.
And I, you know, by 75, I had the confidence to do it. Even 73, my first year as a rookie, I pitched well. I was 7-6 that year, and you know, understood that a little bit better. Then I got to cut away from that in 74, for whatever reason, but I just know in 75 and 76, I couldn't throw the baseball any better than I did those 2 years.
You know, in 75, you got a save in the All-Star game.
Yes, I did. That was kind of unique. And
tell me about that situation.
You know, it was Andy Messersmith and I were left in the bullpen. And I just assumed that it might be Andy and I wasn't going to pitch. Mm-hmm. That was kind of my thought. But I didn't mind that. I made the All-Star team. I was proud of that. You know, first Padre pitcher to ever be invited to, you know, pitch in an All-Star game or be part of the team. And so anyway, we got the 8th inning, and we got the lead, and all of a sudden the phone rang, and Andy picked it up, and Walter Alston, he said, Andy, he says, give me that little left-hander, the curly-haired kid that gets everybody out. He couldn't remember my name. That's what he called me. And so Andy hung up the phone, laughed, told me that, and he goes, that's got to be you, Jonesy, get loose. So, hey, 20 pitches later, I was running out the gate toward the mound.
Did you get nervous at any point?
Yeah.
When you're in?
You better. Every start, I got nervous.
Really?
I don't remember.
Your entire career, huh?
My whole career.
Hmm.
There wasn't any time I went out there that adrenaline wasn't flying and I was nervous, had to settle myself down.
Huh?
Yeah, and you better hope you're like that. You better be.
Or you won't be able to perform because you don't have...
There's something, like there's something wrong with you.
It's a sign of caring, perhaps.
That's right. That's a, in my opinion, you know.
So what... If 76 the Cy Young year, do you feel that you pitched better in 75 or 76?
75.
Okay.
I think over... I mean, I pitched great in 76. I mean, I had 40 starts. I think I had one start where I really... I didn't have anything, one start. The other 39, I had good stuff. Mm-hmm. The makeup of the team and everything. I mean, I got beat 1-0 went four times and had the lead in four games and ended up with no decisions with the bullpen coming in. I mean, that'd be eight more wins if I was completely lucky, mm-hmm. you know. And that could have been 30 wins right there all by itself that year. And I think I threw the baseball so well, but I just think I was more dominant in 75. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, I just think I gave up fewer hits. I think it was just a more of a positive year. And you know, being runner up to Seaver and the Cy Young didn't bother me much.
Yeah.
You know, never want you go from 8-22 to being a runner up and comeback player of the year. And I was pretty proud of that. I was proud of winning the ERA title. I won it the last day of the year because Mr. Smith pitched, Seaver pitched, and I pitched the last day of the season. And Buzzy Bavese asked me if I wanted to set out and not pitch, win the ERA title. And I said, no, I think I'm going to go out and earn it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did. That's the way I wanted it. And so it was a fantastic year. And that was really the turning point. It made 76 even possible.
You also were very strong defensively.
Yes.
You started, I think, 12 double plays in 1976 and just had a... accepted a league-leading number of chances and had a perfect fielding percentage and three assists in an inning. I talked with Jim Cott once, and he said something to the effect of he tried to always finish his motions so that he was stable and ready to field.
Yeah, and more importantly, Jim did the same thing. I pitched to contact. So every time I threw a pitch, I anticipated being hit at me. Mm-hmm. The ball never surprised me. You know, because the way I pitch, you're supposed to. I'm trying to get you to hit ground balls.
Pitcher is a fielder.
Yeah. And I mean, I better be able to field my position or it's going to cost me. It's going to cost me a game. I mean, I remember Luis Melendez. I threw a 10-inning one-hitter against the Cardinals one night. I beat him 1-0. Johnny Grubb hit a home run in the bottom of the 10th for me to win. And I gave up one hit, and that one hit was Luis Melendez hit a little grounder to my right. And it just ticked off my glove and rolled out about 5 yards. That was the only hit I gave up that night. Mm-hmm. You know, all you do is catch that and pitch a no-hitter, theoretically. Mm-hmm. You know, when you hindsight, but you know. And that was in the seventh inning. But, you know, and I was just always took a lot of pride in fielding my position. I knew it was going to be imperative for me. You know, it's like doing damage control when you got second and third, nobody out. All right, I might give up a run, but you know, let's get through this. You know, so it's all how you handle in those situations, I think.
In 76, you entered the All-Star break at 16-3.
Yes.
That's a record that no one has achieved since.
No.
I mean, that sounds like a situation where everything broke right for you.
It did.
Because wins aren't always in a pitcher's control.
Right. Four-man rotation, I pitched every fourth day, and I got great run support from the Padres that year, unique with the first half. You know, and I say... A lot of run support, that's three or four runs. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of runs in. And then that was plenty for me. But, you know, in my opinion. And they just continued to, you know, everything just fell right. But I pitched so well, so consistent. And I think I won 10 or 11 in a row, close to that, during that span in late April, May, even June. But, it just everything just fell together. And I was in such a good groove that it was just unbelievable.
How would what was the fan reaction to your success?
Well, the local fan reaction it was just phenomenal. I mean, I really seemed like I got to share a lot of it from opening day of 76. I think we had like 55,000, and I walked down to warm up and got a standing ovation from all 50,000 people. Mm. You know, and I appreciate. I'll never forget it. And it just seemed like I made 19 more starts there at home, and that year half my starts were in San Diego. And I think I averaged like 35,000 fans a game. They'd come out to watch me pitch. Number one, we had a chance of winning. Number two,
the first time.
The game was 2 hours long, and then you go home. I think that, fans like that, because they bring their kids to a game middle of the week, and I'd have them out of there by 9 o'clock. And I was pretty good at that. But I just think the relationship with the fans was really unique at that point in time. And I really enjoyed that, never forgot it.
And partially, it's the first time the Padres really had a chance.
Yeah, well, I had to be the first player that actually made an impact in Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. I was doing some things that no one would even dream of a San Diego Padre would do. And that might have started at the end of 75 when I won the ERA title, won my 20th game, at the last week. The last week of the season, really my second to last start, I won my 20th. And, then they started getting behind me, and it just rolled all into 76. And it was just great. Every time I'd pitch, there'd be 30 or 40,000 people in the stands. And the next day, we'd come back, there'd be 9, 8.
So you kind of know your own marginal revenue product, right?
It was pretty excited. Yeah, and I think the guy, the bigger crowds are motivated to think that my teammates would even play even more, even better. It does that. And I think it really did that season.
In the end of 76, you hurt a nerve in your arm?
I snapped a nerve, yeah.
And when it happened, did you have a sense that something was significantly wrong?
Not significantly wrong. I knew my arm was tired. I had 315 innings when the game started. And I knew my arm was tired, but I went to warm up. And there was a red flag there. When you're 26 years old and you're damn near invincible at 26. I know that. And I warmed up and had good stuff. Pitching against the Reds. And I thought about halfway through my warm-ups of handing the ball back and not making the start. And my arm was tired. And I just couldn't do it. I couldn't hand you the baseball. I couldn't do it. So I went out, and it was the third inning. I just remember I threw one slider, and I just felt something weird, like the rubber band went off. And I went, what the hell is that? And I threw a couple more pitches, and it just didn't feel right. And that's when I called John McNamara, my manager, up and said, ain't right, Skip, I got to come out. This ain't right. And my arm was so tired that I didn't even pick up a baseball the next couple of days. And we ended up going up to play the Dodgers at the end of the season. And so Dr. Job came in, the trainer wanted him to just check my arm and stuff, and I'm sitting there talking to him. And he's checking my arm, and I'm not paying attention. He said, make a muscle, and so I did. And he said, no, I said, make a muscle. I did. I looked down, and my bicep was gone. I go to make a muscle, and there was nothing there. Huh. And that's when I knew something was wrong. I said, that's not good, guys. Huh. And that's when I realized that it hurt.
So what exactly happened?
Well, no, I just actually snapped the nerve here. And I had a piece of the nerve here, and there's nothing they could do. It just had to grow back.
Okay.
You can't fix a nerve. It's got to regenerate.
Yeah, that's a peripheral nerve, right?
So they went in thinking it was a tendon or they might have to, fix something. Mm-hmm. And then when I woke up and they walked in, they said, man, we opened you up and sewed you back up. I'm like, what? And he said, you snapped a nerve, man. You've never seen that before, but you snapped a nerve in your elbow. And he said in a nutshell, and I said, that's what it should be. And he goes, if it grows back, you'll get to pitch again. If it doesn't, you're done. I said, that's simple.
That's got to be harrowing news to someone of your age, with your success, thinking you're poised for Cooperstown.
I just kind of ignored that, and I said, let's see how it plays out. And so finally by December, I was duck hunting up in Northern California, and I woke up that morning out of my sleeping bag by the fireplace, and I rolled over and leaned on my arm, and there was just a little thread of muscle right here. Just a little thread. And right then and there, I had some hope. I jumped up, was all excited, and went from there. I ended up I snapped it 5 times before I retired.
You recovered. You certainly pitched effectively through 1980.
Yeah, I did. I pushed it in 77, and when I first came back, we got off to a poor start, and I was trying to go 6 or 7 innings, take care of my arm a little bit. And we were scuffling so bad, I finally just threw my hands up. I think I told my wife, I said, I'm just going to go 9 tonight. Hell with it. I'm going to beat the Phillies. So I did. I went out, went 9 innings, and think it was the very next start. You know, I just wasn't right. I'd fatigued that nerve so much, it, mm-hmm. you know, I damaged it again.
In retrospect, should you have taken a year off or something?
Well, I should have kept it slow, or at least taken the first half off and got my arm a little bit stronger and let that nerve really solidify. Mm-hmm. And I did that, I thought, in 78 and 79. Like I averaged about 280 innings both those years. And threw the ball really well. Not as well as 75, 76, no. But still, it was well enough to win ball games if I'd have got some run support and yada yada. But felt pretty good. But even then, there was still a lot of maintenance on this. I mean, I'd go up and pitch 8 or 9 innings and have my bicep atrophy.
Okay, it sounds as though you could pitch without pain
right.
for periods of time, but if you sort of hit the wall, it would start bothering you again, and it was just a chronic nuisance, and you never really knew what you'd get.
Yeah, but I would just have to work. I'd have to work out a little bit more with weights and that type of thing in between starts. It was just a lot of work to maintain it, but it was worth it. But then finally, in 1980, that's when I snapped it again, middle of the year. And I tried to come back, I think, at the end of the year, but I probably shouldn't have. And just a lot of work. And then that's when I got traded to the Mets. And I knew I was rolling the dice. I knew the Mets were rolling the dice with me because I didn't know what my arm was going to do.
Yeah.
And mentally and your legs, everything else is the same, John. But you can only do what your arm's going to let you do.
Did it take a toll on other parts of your body?
No.
Because you weren't
no.
overcompensating?
No.
Okay.
Really didn't. It was just all arm. Because I know I started, 81, the strike year, that was just a rough year. I hurt it early, yeah. Damaged the nerve, and then we went on strike for, 52 days. That didn't help.
Yeah.
Trying to come back from that, that didn't work out to be a very productive year at all. It was awful. So I worked pretty hard, trying to get back to it. 82, George Bamberger was my manager, and finally, I got up to a pretty good start. I pitched in San Diego, a little bit iffy. My next start was in San Francisco, pitched really well up there. Then I went and shut out Houston, a complete game the same week. I had 2 wins, was National League Pitcher of the Week that week. It was pretty cool, though. I was going back to New York, and I was pretty excited, and the ball club was, too. I was throwing the baseball like I used to, and I was. And I got to the third inning, and my next start did Shea, and that rubber band went off again.
Mm. So you almost never, you knew it was coming, but you never knew when it was coming.
I didn't know, and you couldn't worry about it, so I just went out and played as hard as I could. But I just knew that day when I did it, I went, I knew I was in trouble.
Mm.
That's not good. And I was right, it wasn't good. And honestly, it never was the same again.
How did you feel about going to New York? The Mets at that time were not a top-tier team.
And I wasn't leaving a top-tier team, so.
And but you were leaving home.
It was just an opportunity, another experience in my, and I had enough years, I didn't have to go.
Mm-hmm.
But I just felt, they were making a change, they were going another direction in San Diego here, and I thought, hey, I'm getting out of the way, and Mets want to take a shot, I'll take a chance, I'll go back and try it.
Mm-hmm.
Very frustrating 2 years, but I just couldn't perform the way I wanted to or expected.
And there's really nothing you could have done.
It's
not, maybe if modern surgery.
I was definitely ready to, hang up the game. I was ready to retire.
After you retired, I know you were active in coaching. And, had Barry Zito, I guess,
yes.
as a famous pupil of yours.
Yeah, well, you see the mound right back up there. The tarp on it. And everywhere I've lived all these years, I've always had a mound in my backyard. I've always had some acreage. Being living out here in this area. And I've always built a mound. I've built too many of them, and I build a mound and do private lessons. And I enjoyed it. I loved doing it. Murphy money, a little bit of money. I didn't do it for free. I charged him $50. Big deal. And but Barry Zito was one kid. He approached me like at 14 years old, his mom and dad. And there was a young man that had that desire. I could see it in his eyes and his work ethic. When I looked at him. I remember another left-hander that looked just like him when he was younger. And I saw a lot of myself in him, and I really enjoyed working with Barry. He had a burning desire to be a big league pitcher, and he worked his butt off. I was impressed, and it came to fruition.
So how much can coaching make a difference in someone's pitching? I mean, you can make
very much so. I think you make very, very much so as far as, you know, arm maintenance and having the right arm action. That's where the consistency comes from. You know, if you had time, I'd tell you to go up and watch Mackenzie Gore, one of our prospects, a left-hander. Great mechanics, duplicates really well, creates a lot of consistency, and it'll make all the difference in the world for this young man, in my opinion. But it's a guy that short arms the ball or has some flaws fundamentally. It's hard to make adjustments sometimes. Mm-hmm. They don't understand, you know, where the adjustment is. And Barry, you got it, you know, a long time. They went through a lot of scenarios with him to find.
And he had ups and downs. And
oh hell yeah, you know, that's pitching, that's baseball. But I think overall, when he was with Oakland, I know he was better. And he was one that, you know, he was on this side of the ball. You know, he didn't turn the ball over at all.
Okay. No, just...
You can't do both.
Okay, so you're either going to be on with your hand rotated out or inside.
Ball's either going to come off this side of your hand or this side.
Okay. And you want to keep doing the same thing all the time.
Yeah, the four seamers here, 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 you know. They said, I don't think this is going to go that way. These tendons aren't going to allow that.
Okay.
That's a no-no.
So if I throw my fastball and I'm tilting my arm slightly inside, I'm putting extra pressure on my elbow.
Well, you're putting pressure on the elbow here. And so if you do it all the time, see, they adjust, they adapt and get used to it. Okay. You know, but like Barry was four-seamer cutting the ball into left-handers in the curveball. And because I know he got frustrated, and I saw him after that a couple years later. He didn't have anything that would go that way, really. And so I showed him. I said, the only thing you can do is you throw a circle change with the seams and make sure it rolls off these fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you do that, now you can get it here, let it roll off, and it'll stay that way. That's the only thing you can do. But don't think you're going to turn the ball over, pal. You're not. And I would advise you not to do that. But that's just how you tear that arm up.
Now, during your career, Fernando Valenzuela was a screwball, and we haven't seen many since.
That's right.
Who have used that, because that pitch does put it.
Oh, it's in, inverted. Yeah.
Inverted, an inverted curveball. Is that the sort of pitch that you would not recommend a pitcher throw just because of the pressure?
If the ball's not coming off the side of your hand and actually tailing, I don't care if you're a right hander or whatever, you know, if it's not coming off the side of your hand, don't even think about it. You're not going to throw it. You might be able to throw it, but it's just, you know, you're going to hurt yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like today's standards of radar guns, 95, you know, 90 miles an hour. Don't even think about it.
What do you think that pitchers develop pitching muscles by pitching or in the gym?
Yeah, you know, throwing.
And does working out in the gym almost make it harder because
if you don't stretch enough. Mm-hmm. And you shorten your muscles up, you're not doing yourself a favor, in my opinion.
Okay.
But if you're stretching and keeping flexibility and building strength, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But a lot of these guys, if you're just going to bulk up, you know, you're not going to really, well, in the most part, you're going to see they're not going to pitch, they're going to throw.
Okay. And I mean,
big difference.
What about strengthen your legs? I mean, is
that's imperative.
It's imperative.
That's running, mm-hmm. in my opinion. Care if it's a bike, running sprints, running distance, stamina. And legs are the key part of any good pitcher.
Okay, and
you got weak legs, you're going to be in trouble.
But I guess I wondered if the power in the legs was mostly for power pitchers, but it sounds as though it's both.
I think it's both. No, I mean, because even a guy like myself, you better have strong legs and a lot of endurance in there if you want to go deep into a ball game.
You've had a lot of ventures since you retired.
You bet.
Whether it's barbecue sauce or, you know, you're always at the stadium. You have a catering business.
Yeah.
Tell me about your entrepreneurial side and where that came from.
Well, number one, it boils back down to, you know, getting my business degree and enjoying the challenge of business. And I always honestly believed if I got into business and was doing something that I really liked to do and I put the same amount of time into it, going to be successful,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I knew work ethic. I knew all about that from baseball. And so it would just slowly, gradually. Yeah. And I took my time. I worked for my sister for a while, traveled the world for her and did some sales. And but it was in the food side of the business. And I did that for like 3.5 years, almost 4 years with her. And in the meantime, I was still involved with the Padres a little bit when I was at home. I do them private lessons, but a lot of times I'd be in the Pacific or in Europe or the Orient, you know, working for her. And there was a kick. And I was kind of doing it all. But, you know, after those 4 years, when I came back and I decided, nah, I don't want to do that anymore. And then we get to the early 90s. And that's when I started thinking about getting back into the game itself. And I didn't want to coach. I wasn't interested in coaching. There are just other things. Like I noticed, you know, being around San Diego, the Padres didn't have a pregame radio show. Mm-hmm. Nobody was doing it. And before that, I'd already talked to the Padres I started doing appearances, community work for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and they were paying me a little minuscule salary, but I'd go out and do speaking engagements all over San Diego for them. I enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed the fans here. It's always been, you know, part of me, and I've always enjoyed that. Nice to have good company. So I started doing that a little bit, and then when I noticed there's no pregame radio show, you know, then the business part of me, I thought, I can do this. And so what I did is I went out and found a sponsor for the radio show. You know, that was a casino, one of the Indian casinos here. And I talked to him, and if I wanted to do a pregame show, they would sponsor it. So I went back to the radio station and met with Dave Sniff, the producer, the head of talent. Said, I want to do a Padre pregame show. And he said, we don't have the budget. And I said, well, I'm bringing the budget. And so I explained to him what I'd done. And so he stood up, shook my hand, goes, congratulations, you started a pregame radio show. And that's how I got into radio. And so we started putting it together. We started doing that. And that started going really well. Next thing I know, a couple months later, I was playing a lot of golf. And I was probably playing like a 2 or 3 handicap. And playing charity golf tournaments all over San Diego all the time. And so anyway, I played golf one day and won a local one here. And I played with a gentleman named Ken Wilson. And he was the head of sports services, food concessionaire at the Murph at the ballpark. And I just met him. So we went out and played golf that day. We won the golf tournament. He was tickled to death. We're having a beer afterwards. And got talking about the upcoming season. And he says, yeah, I need one more eating spot in the ballpark, I think. We'll be ready to go this year. And I looked up and said, how about the Randy Jones Barbecue? He says, well, what's that? I go, I don't know. I just thought of it. You know, I said, but a boot can do it in Baltimore. Why the hell can't I do it here? And he laughed. And 6 weeks later, we opened it up. That's how I got in the barbecue business. My grandpa had a barbecue sauce, so I did that, but everything else we put together in a matter of 6 weeks and opened it.
And you're able to have a connection to baseball, which not every player gets.
Exactly. Yeah. And so all of a sudden, I found myself doing PR work for the ball club, doing a pregame radio show that took off and was really doing well, as a matter of fact. And then the barbecue took off, and that really took off. And literally, Keno took a liking to the idea when he came in, and. Because we were talking one day out at my barbecue, and Larry and I were laughing a little bit. Just before he left, and I was out in right field by the flagpole at the Murph, you know, kind of way out.
Yeah.
And he says, anything else I can do for you? And I said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, if you could just move me right behind home plate and make me the mayor of Padre Street, I'd probably do really well for me. And he started laughing, turned around and walked away. Never thought anything about it. So about 6 days later, Ken Wilson came by, and he goes, he looked at me and goes, I don't know what you did. He said, but next Thursday, the off day? And I went, yeah. He goes, we're moving you upon home plate. I said, what?
Wow.
He goes, we're moving your ass behind home plate. You know? And, as soon as we moved it, I quadrupled my business. It was insane. I went from like, I think I had 15 redwood picnic tables to 32. I needed more room for people to eat. And then I 96 and 81 dates, we did almost $1 million in sales at that barbecue stand.
Wow.
It was insane. Every night, long lines, it was phenomenal. And at that point in time, I mean, I was there every day. I get done doing radio, go straight to the barbecue, get out there, and a lot of times I was barbecuing, I was back behind there barbecuing and throwing plates together and having a blast. Mm-hmm. You know, just talking to the folks or clearing tables, getting people to finish eating so I could feed more. You know, then I just had a blast doing it. It was fun, and it was just all good. Everything was really positive, and I just continued on. And even by today's standards, I'm theoretically doing the same thing that I was doing then. It just changed after 25 years. You know, got a new barbecue person at the ballpark, you know, Petco.
Wow.
So I just had to remodel my menu. You know, hot dogs, bratwurst, kielbasses, and barbecue those. And, you know, change it to RJ's Grill, not barbecue, because Phil's doing all the barbecue. And after 20-some years, you don't get emotional. You just adapt. You know, and of course, doing the pregame show turned into the postgame show, and I was doing both for 20 years. And I was, you know, doing that until midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning every single game. You know, even when they're on the road, we'd go in and do the pre- and postgame show. Huh. And then finally I burned out of that a couple of years, 3 years ago, and said, I'm done. I can't stay up that late anymore. I'm too old. I said, I said, listen, I'll do pregame, but I'm not doing postgame. You get a kid to go do that shit. I'm not doing it. You know. And so they were really cool about it. So now I have a little 7-8 minute segment in the pregame show that I do every game. You know, I'll do it again today. And then when I get a chance and I'm down at the ballpark, you know, I have 7 RJ Grills there, little hot dog stands all over the ballpark, quite a few of them. But I try to hit 2 or 3 and just say hi to a few people, my employees. And not there very long, but just say hello. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of charity work now, a lot of charity groups, our military kids. I do a lot of things. Like tomorrow I'll have like 20 military kids down for BP and the game tickets, and I'll feed them at my grill and, you know, spend some time with them. And just make it a special day for some of our military kids. And I've been in families. I've been doing that now for like 3 or 4 years. I like doing that. So, and it just, you know, I've been, you know, around the clubhouse, you know, talking to the guys, just keep it positive. And I've been doing that now for 12 years. Go to spring training every year for about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, put the uniform on, I'm out there with the guys. And just kind of getting to know them and talking to a lot of the pitchers. And, you know, not overly analytical or yelling at anybody, but they're just little mental things I know that they can do better, that they're not thinking right on when I watch them, and I mention it to them. But I just keep it positive, because I know how hard it is. And so I love doing that with those kids as well.
In our last few minutes, I'll just ask you a few random baseball questions.
Sure.
What was the best team you ever faced?
The Big Red Machine, Cincinnati Reds. Absolutely the best team.
Best in terms of raw talent, coaching?
Raw talent, I mean, I think the Big Red Machine, that Ray Charles could have won with him. He's blind, that's right.
Yeah.
I've been telling you right now, Sparky did to put him out there and leave him alone.
Yeah.
He's had to decide when he's going to bring Pedro Barbone in. That's all he's going to do. But having just a phenomenal team. I had a lot of success against him, but I'm still the best ball club I've seen assembled and put together. The way they executed, the way they played the game was unreal.
In 74, Steve Garvey won the MVP. Lou Brock stole 118 bases. Who should have won?
Whoa. Garvey. Okay. In my opinion, just analyzing the 74 and the year that he had, you know, impact on the game itself and his team, mm-hmm. It was Steve Garvey.
Okay.
I mean, 118,
I mean,
he
got them to the World Series. So.
Yeah, I mean, and he was an integral part of that lineup. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Lou Brock had a great year, but still, not, I don't think Lou's 118 didn't have the impact that Steve Garvey had day in and day out with the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. And it might be because I played the Dodgers 18 times. I saw a lot more of Garvey than I did Lou. I know at least one or two of those 118 were me.
Yeah, I'm sure they were.
I guarantee you that.
In the 1979 Pirates, team that came back from a 3-1 deficit in the World Series. I've always felt that Willie Stargell's impact on that team has been understated.
No shit.
What's your opinion of Stargell, both as a player, as a person, and his impact on that team?
Oh, just unbelievable. His impact was unbelievable, in my opinion. And he'd been like that for quite a while. As far as the mainstay for the, you know, the family, the Pirates, mm-hmm. Yeah, he was an integral part and kept all them together and motivated that team. I mean, Willie Stargell, he was the guy that won that World Series for him. There's no doubt in my mind. I don't care if you're talking about whether it's bad or him just being there day in and out and keeping that team focused. Pops was the best over there. I really had a lot of respect for Willie Stargell.
How did you feel about the 81 strike when it happened, and how do you feel about it now?
81 strike, I just didn't like it too much. Got all the way home, 52 days. Went all the way back. Had my family with me in New York. And we jumped in the truck, and I just cruised back all the way to San Diego, visiting relatives in Arkansas and Texas, and my mom and dad's side. And, you know, we even went and saw Gene Tennis in St. Louis on the way home, because we were friends, his teammates here. in San Diego. I went by and said hi to him for a couple of days. But then I finally got back home and had to fly back, and it was a pain, and I don't know what it cost me. It cost me $60,000-$70,000 in payroll salary that year. But I knew any time that when we walked that one on strike, I understood what it was for. I'd been a player rep. I knew it was trying to represent where we were trying to get. Had no idea we'd ever get to where we are today, mind you. But just to make it, you know, more of an opportunity for players in our pension and everything else that we were fighting about. It was worth it.
Mm-hmm. Which Padre would we be more of a household name if the Padres had been good teams back then?
Well, that's a great. I mean, it would change every couple of years. I mean,
let's just say the 75-76 period, for lack of a better team. Which, because often you see with teams that are struggling, guys get buried that this wouldn't you don't get to hear about.
Well, that's a tough one there. Might be like, I would say Johnny Grubb would probably get more noticed. Hit almost 300 in many, many years.
Johnny Grubb's been lost in the shuffle over the years.
He really did get lost in the shuffle there.
Even when he played in Texas
I look back at the team then, and it was a makeup of Willie McCovey and Tito Flynn is on the right side.
And guys were either really young and inexperienced or really old.
Yeah, and Enzo Hernandez to Hector Torres to Ozzie Smith at short, and Billy Allman and Tucker Smith and Doug Rader at third base at different times. So, you know, for me, I mean, I think maybe one of the unsung heroes, my personal opinion was actually my personal catcher, Freddie Kendall, was one of the original San Diego Padres from 69. Yep. And Freddie was kind of an unsung player. Never really got the notoriety or opportunity. I know in 73, he almost hit 300 that year. But he just kind of went unnoticed across the way and did a great job behind the plate. And, you know, kind of being the glue for that ball club a lot of times. And, you know, if there's somebody. But he'd never been a Hall of Famer. He'd never had the numbers. And I can't tell you there's one guy on that team, 75, 76, that had those kind of numbers.
Yeah, I don't think we had a Hall of Famer in there.
Sorry, man, no.
What was McCovey like as a teammate?
Yeah, real professional. Did the game right, enjoyed him very, very much, you know, just by leading by example, didn't have to say too much, you know, just it's great having him around and just what he meant to baseball, and he's the first class guy that he was.
Now, my last question to you is, what's your opinion of this current Padres team and hope for the future?
This current Padres team is probably the most excited I've been in 45 years. I'm so impressed with the new ownership.
More so than 98?
Oh, easily.
Okay. Really?
Yes, sir. 98, I think, was a one-year thing, trying to get a new Petco Park built by design. Right now, what I see, I just see so much depth. We have guys in the minor leagues playing baseball right now for the Padres who think they're better than the guys starting at the major league level.
Mm-hmm.
And I never could have said that ever before.
So you're more excited about this Padres group than, let's say, the 84 bunch.
You're damn right I am.
Really?
I am very excited about this whole group of guys.
Even though the Padres of 84 had Gwynn, Nettles, Gossage, a young core.
Templeton. Yeah, great team.
Really?
But I just know what the core that you have right now, I'm looking at the left side of the infield that could be there for the next 10 years.
Machado certainly better be there for the
and
next
Tatis
10 years.
And Tatis better be there right beside him. He's that good, that young man's. Mm-hmm. He's going to make Machado really good.
You think there's a World Series title potentially in the next couple of years?
Yeah, if we can get this pitching staff together like I know we can. That's all we're missing right now.
Mm-hmm.
If we had two or three good starters, and it might be Denelson Lamet, who's just going to come back against the Dodgers this weekend after surgery. Garrett Richards supposed to come back. I need to see more of him. With Mackenzie Gore and even Chris Paddock and some of the kids who we have right now. I mean, who's going to step up and get us to that next level? We have a lot of options. You know, but it's the best five starters.
Yeah.
That's just the way it works. Hang in there. That's what, you know, there's no second place.
That's right.
But what I do like is even have, let's say it's 3 or 4 years of these guys, we're so deep with talent, and I expect that to continue. with AJ and the ownership that we have here. That's their full intent, and I believe them. And I'm just thoroughly excited about these kids. I really am. This is going to be fun, man.
Randy Jones, thank you for taking time to speak with me for this Sabre Oral History today.
John. Good to see you, buddy.
My pleasure.